Menders, Episode 25, Elevating Caregivers as Part of the Healthcare Team with Jennifer O'Brien.
When I was in the more corporate setting, I wished that on my computer screen every morning, a little dashboard would pop up that would say, you know, we cared for this many patients yesterday, we delivered this many babies, and we comforted this many dying people. Like, how great would that be, right? Because that's what I want.
You're listening to Menders with clinical psychologist and leadership consultant, Dr. Nicola DePaul. Each week, get a dose of real-world inspiration from free-thinking leaders, top clinicians, healthcare innovators, and myself. Looking for quick fixes or standard management tools? Try someplace else. Motivated to maximize the resilience and diversity of your team, sustain your momentum as a leader, and transform your healthcare system? Welcome to Menders. Well, welcome to Menders. Today we have Jennifer O'Brien. And Jennifer, you're a published author. You've written The Hospice Doctor's Widow. You're also a healthcare executive. You've worked in a variety of settings. And you spent part of your life as a spouse and caregiver while your husband was going through end-of-life care. So I'm really thrilled to have you. And I invited you to talk with me today on Menders about how we can think about using empathy and paying attention to the caregiver experience to transform healthcare. So thank you for being with me.
It is my absolute pleasure and honor, Nicola, to be with you today.
Well, we are together in that. So thank you. So I would love to start out by having you introduce yourself and share a little bit about your journey. What brought you to this moment and to be interested in these topics?
Well, thanks. So I have been in healthcare for 35 years. It started out with a boutique consulting firm teaching physicians practice management concepts. I tell people it was when I was 12, but it wasn't. It was when I was 22. And that sort of morphed. You learn a lot when you go to a practice and figure out what they're doing wrong and try to help them fix things. And then I got my master's degree in organization development, which kind of sent me into, organizational change and the people side of healthcare organizations, which is pretty important to me. And then started doing quite a bit of interim leadership for very large physician practices and somewhat in academic settings as well. And it was in one of those interim CEO positions when I came down from Chicago, which is where I lived at the time. I came down to Little Rock, Arkansas to be the interim CEO for a large orthopedic surgery practice. And it was typically, these kinds of interim things last 2 to 4 years. I'm not a lifer when it comes to these administrative roles. I find that it's better for everyone involved. I'm a change agent, so it's a lot better when they don't think they can fire me when they know I'm leaving anyway, for me to be able to get folks to make changes. And so I came down to Little Rock to do this 2 to 4 year at the most CEOing job with a bunch of orthopedic surgeons and all of their ancillary services. And I met and fell in love with my now late husband, Bob Lemberg. And Bob had been a plastic and reconstructive surgeon for over 30 years. And then because of a residual neck injury and pain, when he was no longer able to operate, he had chosen to retrain in hospice and palliative medicine. And I was really smitten with this. You know, anybody who could have an incredibly successful surgical career probably could have retired easily at that point, but chose to retrain and chose specifically palliative care was, you know, that was pretty impressive. I had already lost my only sibling when I was 18, and I lost my mother some years later to pancreatic cancer. So I was familiar with how important the role of palliative care is in people's lives. And besides, he was just super cute and very funny. And so I fell crazy in love and we got married and it was awesome. And I did finish out the orthopedic job that lasted a couple more years. And Bob was on faculty at our med center here in Little Rock. And I went back to doing some of the consulting and teaching. And then Bob found a couple of lumps on the left side of his neck, and it turned out to be a metastatic stage 4 clear cell carcinoma. And so now what he had done for patients and families for years and we had talked about around the dinner table was now, you know, we were turning that on ourselves and we were applying that to ourselves. He lived for 22 months following the diagnosis. And I kept an art journal purely as a form of self-care. I am a self-taught collage artist. and I kept this journal, to be quite honest, I know for a fact Bob never saw any of it. I don't know if he even knew it existed. It was just for me and kind of, you know, taking care of myself and having a place to express my thoughts and feelings and having a place to document some of the concepts that were so important in his practice. And now we were applying to ourselves. So anyway, 22 months and he died, and we did extensive preparation for his death and my survivorship. And then I went back to work again in an interim CEO position. I kept going with the journal for about a year and a half after he died. And I was in one of these CEO positions with a multi-specialty clinic, and this neurologist was telling me how he was in the process of diagnosing 3 patients with ALS. And I brought my journal in to show him. He took it home and he came back the next day and he said, "Yeah, Jennifer, you're not getting your journal back."
Hey, if you're listening to this and you're not sure how to get started to address burnout and create a culture of well-being in your organization, and you're looking for a roadmap and someone to support your team through this process, listen up, because this is for you. Investing in your people is the smartest thing your healthcare system can do. Whether you have a tiny system or a large, complex department, there are focused actions you can take to transform your organizational culture from burnout to well-being. I work with leadership teams to simplify and demystify this process so that you can feel really good about the efforts you're putting out in the world and so confident that your investments in employee engagement and team well-being will pay dividends. Head on over to mendinghealthsystems.com and join me today.
I will be loaning it to these 3 patients and their spouses because it really helps fill a gap between what I can do for the patient and what the family caregiver really needs. And you need to figure out how to get this thing published, because this needs to be available to more people than just these 3. And, well, you can imagine how compelling that was, right? Like, the idea that my little art journal might help somebody was pretty compelling. So I went to work. I found a local, small, independent press that was willing to take a chance on it. It is a very unusual book. And they published it, and it has won 4 awards, including a Nautilus Award, which is just, you know, wonderful and a little mind blowing to me. And moreover, it has helped a lot of families who are dealing with very serious illness that will likely end in the death of their loved one. I know that's a long-winded story, but that's the story, and that's kind of how my work has evolved. It's talk about holistic. I mean, this is really my whole life, right there in a nutshell. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. Well, thank you so much. And I have not seen the journal physically, but I've seen the online version, and it is stunning. I mean, it's absolutely gorgeous and so meaningful. And, you know, as you were sharing about your husband, Bob, I was actually reminded of an experience when, before I became a psychologist, a dear friend of mine had an infant who was on hospice. And it was such a, it was like a very beautiful experience and a very, of course, a very painful and, you know, tragic experience, but also just a very isolating experience, I think, for her in particular. And so I'm, you know, I have that memory of being in, you know, this little child's hospital room over a period of time. And I'm thinking about what you were describing in terms of paying more attention to caregivers. And, you know, and I do recall this mom in particular really, you know, was kind of the primary caregiver, primary nurse, even in the ICU, which was, you know, is not necessarily what you would expect, but I think is the reality that families play such a critical role. So a lot of thoughts in my mind about how we can take better care of caregivers. And then I'm also contextually just thinking about how families' role has really changed in COVID times. So maybe that is a question I will save for another moment. But I am curious, like, how do you think the healthcare system could shift so that we're better honoring and valuing the role that caregivers are playing on the healthcare team?
Well, thank you for asking that question. I think it's so important. The first step, I think, is recognizing the family caregiver. We're going to use the term caregiver. And of course, I'm always referring, when I use the word caregiver, I'm always referring to the uncompensated or family caregiver. I'm not referring necessarily to the professional caregiver. So if the professional caregivers were a little bit better at recognizing the role of the family caregiver. I think if you've ever had a patient that left your office or was discharged and you thought to yourself, I wish I could influence this care a little bit further beyond this clinical environment, that extension is the family of you is the family caregiver. That person exists. They can be a clinician extender of sorts if they are simply recognized. I can tell you that eye contact is a good start. I don't feel like my husband's oncologist, you know, looked me in the eye more than a handful of times. It was unfortunate because I was in some ways, you know, the better part of his care team was me. I was with him at the end, certainly 24/7. In the beginning when he was still working and so forth, you know, at night in the difficult times, I had a very clear picture of what he was struggling with and what he wasn't. So I actually recently, in this exact question of, you know, who is the family caregiver and what does the family caregiver do? And again, just to clarify terms, we use the word family. It doesn't have to be a blood relative to or a marital relative to be, right? It's just the person. So I actually took my background in healthcare leadership and my experience as a family caregiver, and I created a position description for a family caregiver, you know, answering the question, okay, what if I had to hire for this position? Like, what would this position look like if I had to hire for this position? And I, of course, you know, did the summary of the position and then the responsibilities and tasks. Of course, I incorporated what I had done. I also ran it by a couple of other people who have the same experience. One of my friends is a pediatrician who has an adult son who has been a quadriplegic for 5 years following a skiing accident. So she was instrumental in lending a couple of, you know, expansions on some things that I had talked about. And she helped me with it quite a bit. And a couple of other people who have both experiences, right? The clinical one and the family caregiver experience. And we came up with a position description that I feel is really accurate. And most people in the clinical environment, when they read it, are stunned, are absolutely stunned at all the things that a family caregiver does. And I can tell you, I can probably recommend that you not share it with anyone whose person has just gotten a big diagnosis, because it's even kind of scary to think about. Like, at the beginning of it, if I had known I was gonna have to do all the things that I had to do, I would have been even more frightened and intimidated than I was. So that's just illustrative of how comprehensive the job is. And I can tell you that, you know, most collective bargaining agreements just wouldn't exist based on this particular position description. I mean, there's nowhere to go with 24/7 coverage, and you cannot leave unless you find your own coverage. I mean, that, right? That's anyway, so it's really good. And I've shared it now with a number of people. It's a free download, and I launched it late last week. So it really hasn't even gotten its legs yet, but it's been downloaded numerous times and by some folks in the business, in the palliative care world, who say, wow, yeah, this is spot on. So I would encourage anybody to first understand what the family caregiver is called upon to do. I would tell any physician who's listening that if you go back to your PGY1 and the in-house call that you did, and the fact that you ran around the hospital and you finally got back to the on-call room and you swore there was a camera because the minute you closed your eyes to sleep, the pager went off or your phone went off, and you had that fatigue and anxiety, right, of PGY1 in-house call. So it's just like that, only the differences are there are no ACGME work limits, right? There's no 80-hour work week for a family caregiver. There's no 4 years of medical school, right, that I can draw on to go, oh yeah, this is this. There's no senior resident or chief or faculty member to catch my mistakes. I'm on my own. If I screw this up, I'm on my own. I have one patient. That patient means the world to me, and I'm pretty sure they are going to die. I mean, that gives you an idea of what it's like to be a family caregiver.
Yeah. So, I mean, how do you think understanding that, seeing that position description would impact how the clinicians kind of engage with patients and their families, their caregivers in these moments, in these situations?
Well, I think, you know, like I said, I think that the first step is knowing you have a caregiver in the room, right? And or in the equation. I think there's something to be said for getting feedback from both the patient and the family caregiver, from treating the family caregiver as a partner in all of this. In front of the patient, because I can also tell you that it's kind of brutal at home sometimes. Bob and I were crazy about each other, but there were times when either emotionally or physically he was feeling so bad that he was quite unkind. And that's always the case. There is always, you know, whether it's the adult children of a parent who's ill, there's always one that takes the brunt of not only the work, but often the sort of criticism and sometimes nastiness that happens. And it's very hard to, you know, I was lucky enough to have been in love with Bob before he got sick and know what families went through. So I knew that was just his pain or his, you know, his physical or emotional pain talking. It wasn't him. But I can't say there weren't moments where I was like, wow, what a jerk you are right now, you know? And I'm not sure I was laughing in that moment. So yeah, the clinician kind of recognizing the role of the family caregiver, doing whether it's, I'm not so sure it's the physician, him or herself, whether maybe it is a member of the team. I really love the palliative care model because, right, that's an interdisciplinary team where there's a social worker, there's an APN, there's a physician, there's a chaplain, and each of them are interacting with different parts of that care unit, right, of that family unit. And then in the morning, usually, the palliative care team alone is having their meeting. So if the social worker had a moment with the wife, the social worker can say, you know, the wife is feeling this way or this incident really impacted such and such. And the whole palliative care team knows. I do think there's a risk sometimes, and I would totally understand if a clinician said, my focus is the patient. I can only be worried about the patient. There is a risk that if someone shows me, the caregiver, too much attention, that both the caregiver and the patient are going to be like, hey, wait a minute. No. I'm the one with cancer, or I'm the one with ALS or whatever. I get that. And nobody wants to feel that way on either side of that. So that's why I do think that it's helpful when the clinician themselves, whomever they are in this team, when they have someone else who can pick up on, you know, signals and questions and say, yeah, the wife was asking me about, you know, end of life care, or the sister was saying this the other day. You know what I mean? Something that helps gain the fuller perspective. I think that interdisciplinary model is a fabulous one. Because it's quite frankly easier sometimes to talk to a nurse or to a social worker than it is to talk to a physician. It really is. Bob would have been the first to say that on his team, you know, that the team was, you know, far larger than him and in fact larger than the sum of its parts, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's beautiful. And I did have the opportunity to have a conversation with a palliative care chaplain a couple of months ago now. And it was pretty remarkable, you know, the role that each member of the team really played in both caring for the patient, the family, the caregivers, and each other. And I'm curious, how do you see the caregiver, I guess, recognizing that this person really can play the role of physician extender? I'm just kind of thinking, like, if we started to recognize that family members were really playing a more active role and are not just sort of passively in the background, but are really present, really caring for that family member in, you know, an intentional and necessary way, I guess I'm just thinking, it seems like the whole team might be able to sort of feel that benefit or feel like they are also being buoyed by another member.
Oh, yeah, I think so. Again, it a lot depends on the dynamics, right, of the relationship. A lot depends on the capacity of the caregiver and the patient for that matter. But yes, in general, I think the caregiver is an under-accessed resource. I really do. I think that family caregivers are basically this invisible structure that is upholding not just our healthcare system, but society to a certain degree. I mean, depending on which reports you read, 1 in 4 or 1 in 5 adults in America is a caregiver. That's a huge number. Those are numbers prior to the pandemic. That's a huge number of people who are on some level taking care, not necessarily living, not necessarily the same way I was taking care of Bob, but, you know, doing errands, doing chores, spending time. And if they live with their care recipient, they are spending an average of 37.4 hours a week caregiving. That's a second full-time job if they're employed outside of the home. That's just an incredible amount of effort. And since I'm up on this soapbox here for a minute, I will say that it's the other place that I think there's a big gap is, you know, is the 9-to-5 schedule. I can tell you as a family caregiver, the stuff goes sideways in the evenings and on the weekends, and it goes especially sideways on the holiday weekends. And we hold on and we hold on to not bother anybody during their holiday weekend. And oftentimes that ends up with then a hospital stay because we didn't call and because no one checked. I would, if I were kind of running the show with a major cancer operation, I would seriously consider scheduling some outgoing outreach during holiday weekends to families that were dealing with serious illness, because it's just that important. And you think there's isolation just on a regular day. You take a holiday, it's unreal how isolated you feel. And then, like I said, if a fever is going to spike, it's going to spike on a holiday weekend. If we're going to have GI distress, it's going to be on a holiday weekend a lot of the times. And so I think a lot can be done for the comfort of the patient and the caregiver, but also just not letting things get to an acute stage if we recognize that. There was an op-ed in the New York Times not too long ago written by a physician who talked after he had taken care of one of his neighbors postoperatively who did not die, but he was absolutely stunned at what we leave to family caregivers to do once we discharge somebody from the hospital. It's just appalling. Stuff that we pay, right, nurses, and we pay attention to ratios in the hospital and all that sort of stuff. But we just, you know, scoot that person right out of the hospital, and the person that all that falls to, whether it's dressing changes or, you know, wound care or whatever, is the family caregiver. I mean, it's amazing what we are putting on family caregivers. So I think the least we can do is kind of bring them into the team and be helped by them, but also help them. Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, what I'm hearing there is that you're really suggesting we move towards a proactive, values-based system of care where we're trying to pay attention to people, prevent things from going south, and putting in enough supports in a really consistent way that both the patient and the caregiver are being supported throughout the entire journey. And that is just so different from what we do. But what a remarkable system to be working in as a clinician and to be in as a patient.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I'm going to go ahead now that you've summed that up so beautifully. And I'm going to add to that I would love to see us in healthcare be far more open to the fact that at the end of life comes death with 100% accuracy. At the end of life comes death, right? Nobody gets out of this life alive. And that there are no do-overs in end of life, right? Not a dress rehearsal. When it happens, it happens. And yeah, it affects those of us who go on living for the rest of our lives. So if that's another thing that Bob and I took on ourselves, this extensive preparation for his death and for my survivorship. I would love to see healthcare do that more and help people do that more. That comforting the dying and having survivors able to focus on the love and the grief rather than decisions about artificial nutrition or ventilation. That's where we need to be, right? That's wellness. We know the death is coming. We're all going to die. The answer, I tell clinicians all the time, when the patient says, am I going to die? There is only one answer to that question. And the answer is yes. The only people who get exceptions to that are EMTs and trauma surgeons who are allowed to say, not today if I can help it. But the answer to am I going to die is yes. You're going to die, and I'm going to die. And if we could talk about it more openly, we just would all do better with it. And grief would not become this insurmountable, chaotic mess. It would be based in love. It would be based, you know, there might be some regrets of life, but not consternation about end-of-life care, not wondering about disposition of remains. Why are we not just talking about those things and establishing them with the people we love? It's a very intimate thing to do, right? It's about as close as you can get to someone to talk about their end-of-life wishes and to pledge to carry them out, whether they are the same as yours or not. That's important stuff. And I think healthcare is the place that we can affect that change. And it's not, honestly, not about money. It's not about money. A lot of people want every life extending measure. And that's okay. It is about alleviating, hopefully one day eliminating, the moral distress that people inevitably come to when they haven't had some discussions about what their wishes are before someone becomes totally ill and incapacitated.
Yeah, I really appreciate you bringing that up. And I did actually have the opportunity to work on a palliative care hospice unit for a little while in my training. And it was such a sacred space to be with people who were dying and who knew they were dying. And I guess just to be able to have really, really honest conversations. And, you know, I definitely can see that there were challenges, especially for family members when, you know, there was a lack of communication or a lack of presence, maybe for a period of time, or just all kinds of things that can get in the way and that make that so difficult. But it's like, if we were able to clear away some of those decisions, allow family members, I guess, to have a break or not to have to make, to be put in the position where they are experiencing moral distress, because they're able to understand intimately and know and value the dignity of their family member and act to respect that. I mean, that's so empowering for everyone in that whole system.
I want to back up for a second, Nicola, and say we the specialty is called hospice and palliative care.
Thank you.
But I want to clarify for everyone that the specialty is palliative care, and within it, one small sliver of the vast specialty of palliative care is hospice. Palliative care and hospice are not synonymous. And I think that's one of the problems, because palliative care is a huge resource in healthcare, but so many people think that those two terms are synonymous and that palliative care means someone is dying or getting ready to die. It does not. I mean, there are so many examples of people getting, help from the palliative care team to manage symptoms, to adjust to the new psychosocial and perhaps economic aspects of an illness, and then not needing palliative care perhaps for the rest of their life. I mean, I have a good friend now who was a patient of Bob's. She was very sick. And he was her palliative care doctor. And, you know, she's still here. She has her third kidney. And he isn't. And she will long outlive him. So palliative care is a lot of extra help for a family of a patient and a patient with serious illness. It can be accessed at any point during that illness. There's a big effort to try to get for certain diagnoses, certain cancer diagnoses especially, to get a palliative consult at the point of diagnosis because it's that much support. It has nothing to do with prognosis. It is a big, wonderful resource in your med center if you have palliative care, and it does not mean anybody is dying or anybody is giving up. That's an important distinction because I'm afraid, you know, a lot of people, I mean, there's a lot of jokes in healthcare, right? About palliative care means, right, you know, just don't say the word palliative care so that nobody knows that you're dying, that kind of thing. That's not true. That palliative care is a huge help. They can come in and get things set straight, and they're a nice complement, if you will, with an E, to oncologic care or neurologic care. Palliative care simply does not mean someone is dying. It just means they have serious illness. And it's also the one specialty that really officially recognizes family caregivers. I mean, there's a huge portion of palliative care devoted to family caregivers, and most other specialties, you know, the family caregiver is considered the invisible second patient. They're sort of there, they have needs, but they don't really get recognized.
Yeah. Thank you so much for providing that clarification. And it's so clear to me that it's such a beautiful model for maybe what healthcare really could move towards.
You know what? That's exactly right. It is a beautiful model. Bob used to absolutely, you know, Bob had been a plastic and reconstructive surgeon before he was palliative care physician. And he just loved the difference in teamwork in palliative care, that he was one member of the team. You know, not necessarily the screaming surgeon who, you know, demands instruments and, right? He really preferred being the team member on a palliative care team. It is with great respect to the various professionals on the team.
Yeah. So what do you think would be different in healthcare if we moved towards that model of teamwork in a more holistic way?
Oh my gosh, I think it would be beautifully different. I really do. I think that healthcare has some, you know, intergenerational trauma, quite frankly. And right now we are not doing much to acknowledge it, much less overcome it. I feel like we're just kind of contributing to it. If we were able to stop and become the type of team that recognizes everyone's contribution, that recognizes people's vulnerabilities, it is not easy emotionally to work in this area. It's not a piece of cake, even for people that make it look like it's a piece of cake, right? It's just not. But if we recognized our own self-care as professionals, if we shared in the responsibility, and then I think if we recognized that at the end of life comes death, our lives would be fuller. I often use the question, and this was long before I met Bob. I used to say, I got rid of my television at one point years ago, because I was like, am I going to really lie on my deathbed and wish I'd watched more Law and Order repeats? No, I'm not. You know, like I use that question a lot. Am I going to lie on my deathbed, and am I going to regret doing this or not doing this? And I think it's a powerful way, you know, to look at things. And so if we just put a little bit more death in life, you know, we would probably live more fully. I would love to see medical schools start having, medical schools, nursing schools, allied health. I'm not just talking about medical schools, but any healthcare school. I would love to see them start putting in place, having the student document advanced care plan, advanced directives as part of their registration. You know, I've been in healthcare leadership for a long time. You are dealing with a lot of employees. Inevitably, one of them is going to have an injury or stroke out or whatever. You know, the idea that we are the hospital or the med center, and this is, I mean, Bob had a patient, I'm sorry, a resident die on rounds once. And the notion that if medical students, and then of course I would extend that to residents and especially faculty, I would love to see CEOs and C-suite teams go in and go through the exercise of documenting and communicating their advanced directives. I don't care what's in them, right? It doesn't matter whether you want everything or you want nothing. That's not the issue. The issue is having them done, both for you personally, so that when the time comes, your family has an idea of what you want, and for the sake of the process, because it's another process that is not easy, but man, it's enlightening. It is enlightening, and it will help you to understand when you know how it felt to sit down with the person you love more than anything in the world and to have discussions about what if they couldn't speak for themselves and, you know, what's going to happen when they die. You know that conversation because you've had it, and now you're facing a couple where one of them has a terminal illness. How powerful is that, right? You can draw on your own experience and say, okay, it's like that, only times all this additional emotion and all of this additional physical challenges. And that would really help us. That would really help us all.
Yeah. I mean, what's been sticking out to me in what you were just sharing, but earlier too, is just we as healthcare providers or our leaders are inseparable from the patients and caregivers we're talking about.
Yes.
It's us.
Yes.
I guess it's really obvious, but it's so beautiful and so powerful. And I know you have experienced a lot of death. I have also experienced a lot of death in my family. And I think being able to come to terms with those losses and our own experience of grief and humanity, like for me, that is so critical. Like that is what being human is about. And I think it really informs our work and how we treat and honor and respect the people who are, you know, coming into our clinics or offices to be cared for. And it just really emphasizes to me how important it is we start to also put ourselves more consistently in that role of the person who is dying, because we all are. That is just the reality. And be able to use that knowledge as a resource to create transformation and change and care. Yeah. So why, that's a big question. I'm just curious, why do you think it is so hard for us to acknowledge that?
It's sad. I think we have morphed one of the things that I've been really deliberate about in returning to my role in healthcare leadership following being a caregiver and the death of my husband is a shift in the language I use and an examination of values. So we talk a lot, or I don't, but people do talk a lot about the war on cancer and we use sports analogies like losing and losing a battle and all that sort of stuff. I think that in healthcare, if we distill down what we do, we care for the ill and injured, we deliver the babies, and we comfort the dying. That's what we do. There's no promise of a cure, right? Most illnesses are chronic and go on for a lifetime. Many illnesses go on for a lifetime anyway. They are not cured. So, so what do we have but care? I just think if we could get it back to that. I used to work for a large investor base. That was air quotes for those of you listening. Investor-based hospital system. And I remember wishing, and I was in a corporate role. Well, not the whole time, but anyway, I was a step removed from patient care at certain points in my tenure with this organization. And I remember wishing, because I loved it. I'm not a clinical person, but I love being close. I love being close to the patient, being able to facilitate a situation where the patient and the family get the care they need, right? I don't do bodily fluids. I don't even have a pet, okay? But to be able to make that happen for someone with people who can handle bodily fluids, I mean, that to me, right? And when I was in the more corporate setting, I wished that on my computer screen every morning, a little dashboard would pop up that would say, you know, we cared for this many patients yesterday, we delivered this many babies, and we comforted this many dying people. Like, how great would that be, right? Because that's what I want. I want that sense of fulfillment. I want that sense of being a part of something larger than myself. I mean, obviously, the given is that I'm being paid fairly and all that sort of stuff. That's a given. But beyond that, what inspires me are those things, not whether or not the stock share is selling at a certain dollar figure. No. That's not why I got into this, right? I would love to see leadership say, no, let's get back to the business. That's not the right word. Let's get back to the core value, which is caring for the ill and injured, delivering the babies, and comforting the dying. Period. QED. There's nothing else to be done or said in our field.
Wow. I love that. That is inspirational. Yeah. I've had a lot of folks saying things like, I wish we were just back in the day where I had my black doctor's bag and I just went to somebody's house. And it's all about the relationship. It's just you and me, you know, caring for each other and or comforting or delivering. I love that. Thank you.
Yes, absolutely. And I love that too. I don't want to negate some other, you know, I know that clinicians struggle with EMR. Listen, let me tell you something. EMR is important. One of the many things that you struggle with when you have a serious illness or you're loving someone who has a serious illness is not having to retell the story 80 million times to the next person who walks in that door. So please keep doing your notes like that. We're not talking about total utopia here. We're just talking about getting back to the core values and doing the stuff that, yeah. So I don't want this to be entirely like unrealistic, dreaminess, but it because it's totally attainable. And we do, and that technology, that's another thing we have to help us get there. So anyway.
Yeah, thank you. But I mean, I guess I'm just hearing all actions coming back to those core values. And they might be really sophisticated, but coming back, being rooted in those core values.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
Yeah. Well, my last question for you is, what has kept you sustainable, both as a caregiver, as a human, now as a widow, as a, you know, just as a woman? What keeps you sustainable?
a balance. I think that's the ongoing thing I strive for is recognizing the whole and the components of it. That is, I need, you know, Bob used to say, don't let yourself get too tired or too hungry. That some of the times when I feel the worst, it's because I, oh my gosh, when was the last time I ate? Or man, I got a crappy night's sleep last night. So it's the physical, and it's the fulfillment. I do a lot, you know, I spend an enormous amount of time alone now. I have, in fact, my father just died about a month ago, so I am now the last one standing in my entire family. So I do spend a lot of time alone. And so I would say I draw on, that basic balance of being. I draw a lot on helping. Makes me really feel good. I do the helper's high thing a lot. And of course my art, that's where the whole journal started. And, I'm enjoying, I always enjoy art, whether it's analog collage or digital collage. I like making, you know, I'm a maker. Yeah. A maker and a helper, and yeah, and those are the but honestly, those are the things that fill me up with, you know, with joy and with goodness, and so this work is really important, but I think what you're doing, you know, what and again, you know, I'm 57. I think it's different than when I was in my 20s or 30s or even my 40s. There's to a certain degree, you know, it's like the deathbed question. I also asked the question about whether someone's going to show up at my funeral. It's getting down to that core. Does this really matter? To me is the question. And in what way does it matter? In what way does it contribute to who I am and who I aspire to be? Those are my things.
Yeah. Core values.
Yep.
Wow. Yep. Well, thank you so much for joining me on Menders. It was such a privilege to have you.
Oh, I really love what you're doing with this podcast. I mean, I think Menders mending each other and themselves is, very, very important.
Yeah. For me, it's all about the caring and coming back to relationship.
Yeah. Yeah. Back to relationship. There's a old article, but still so relevant, by a guy named Joseph Simone. And Bob used to quote this article all the time. The institution does not love you back. The people love you, but the institution does not love you back.
I learned that lesson on maternity leave. It was a hard lesson to learn.
Yes, I bet.
Yeah. Oh, well, thank you again. And for those folks who are listening who may have any friends or family members, loved ones who are struggling with end of life, I do recommend you check out The Hospice Doctor's Widow, a journal. It is beautiful. So thank you so much today, Jennifer.
Thank you for listening to Menders. If you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to subscribe, leave a review, and share this episode with a friend. And don't forget to head on over to mendinghealthsystems.com to get started creating cultural transformation for your healthcare team today. Let's create transformation magic.